Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
And here's Peter just to prove it.
Yes, and we're talking about that good beverage called vino.
We are. Okay. Vino tinto or vino rosso or vino bianco. Or
vino veritas.
Vino, actually, mostly, yeah, vino veritas too. Mostly vino tinto
vino veritas
today. And this is not a makeup for the fact that we did booze 2 weeks ago. It's that we came across some very interesting people who know a lot about wine. Two fascinating ladies. Anne's always fond of ladies making wine.
I'm always fond of fascinating.
Yeah, you're fond of fascinating too. Fascinating females are always right. A great addition to the program. In one of the world's and one of the United States' best new wine-growing regions, namely the state of Oregon. So we found two ladies, and we're bringing them to you this morning. And then right after that, a real authority on the subject of wine and a great writer as well.
So a brilliant writer,
yeah,
yes.
We'll introduce you to him when we get around to it. But
okay.
In alphabetical order,
okay.
Therefore, we will have Lynn Penerash and Allison Sokol-Blosser. And starting out with Lynn, here's her story. There's a joke they tell in California in wine circles. Question is, how do you make $1 million in the wine business? And the answer is you start with $5 million.
Yes.
Now, it's a little different in Oregon, and Lynn Penerash is joining us from that state right now. But nevertheless, getting started in the wine business, it seems to me to be kind of brave.
It certainly is.
But you had it, you said before we came on the air, vines were in your blood.
Yeah, the vines were in my blood, that's true.
Tell us about why.
Well, it's kind of an interesting story in that my grandparents grew Thompson Seedless down in the Sanger area outside of Fresno. And so as a kid, it was coming home to the farm in the summers. We'd return and visit them. And there's something about, for me, the smell of diesel and dirt, honestly, that reminds me of those summers spent with my grandparents.
So you said never really thought about doing anything else?
No, I had actually. I had actually worked at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., and loved botany. And my first passion was really botany, and I thought that I would return to the Smithsonian Institute as a botanist. So I actually went to the University of California, Davis, with the idea of becoming a botanist. And kind of got sidetracked when I discovered that the Napa Valley was actually only about an hour's drive away from Davis.
And it's probably one of the world's leading wine programs.
Exactly. Well, at the time, you know, this is now, we're talking 30 plus years ago, it was one of the only programs.
Right. So a lot of people like, who's our friend from Paso Robles?
Oh, well, there's, you know, Zelma Long was my inspiration and Marty
okay.
Bannister.
Okay, so these are people who went on to distinguished careers in winemaking.
That's correct, and they're the ones that actually, when I was just starting out, were my initial mentors as I contacted women in the industry. And those are two of the women that I spent some time with trying to figure out exactly what I wanted to do once I did graduate.
I remember we talked to Eileen Crane at Domaine Carneros.
Yeah.
And she was telling us her story of how she managed to get a job in winemaking. And somebody had called the head of her class to ask if there are any winemakers available in their class. And she said, well, the only ones I have left is a woman, and you wouldn't want her.
Well, I actually worked for Eileen Crane when she had just gotten the job at Domaine Chandon.
Really?
Quite an amazing place, huh?
Yeah, it was an amazing experience. Very romantic to be out on the crush deck at midnight crushing grapes and the smell of the fruit and the tractors are still rolling in and lights are on. It was just a great time.
But how did you convince your husband who wasn't into grapes? Perhaps he was into grapes.
No, he was not. He was actually into education. He was teaching at elementary grade levels for many years, and we met and married in the Napa Valley, and when I was offered a position to move, the one that kicked me a door.
And that was when you went to Rex Hill?
That's correct, yeah. That was back in 1980.
Well, we don't have to say that. We could say it was just 5 years ago.
Okay.
and we had a very enjoyable stay at a place called the Allison, which is, I think, just around the corner.
Yes, it's 3 miles
from where
away.
We used to work. But then you had this crazy idea. I have $5 million to throw around. Why don't I lose it?
Well, we had actually zero cash to throw around, but we still jumped off the cliff. We just felt that at our current age and where our young family was, if we were ever going to venture off and try to do something on our own, we had to do it then and there. So in 2002, we actually both left our current positions and went into business together and crafted and created the wines of Panarache Wine Cellars full-time.
And they're Oregon Pinot Noirs, that much we know, but characterize them more than that.
Well, for us stylistically, I'm very much about the textural experience of the wine, and so we've worked very, very hard to craft wines that have a beautiful experience not only from the nose, but once you put them in your mouth, you're experiencing a textural experience from tip of your tongue all the way back as you swallow that wine. And more often than not, people come into the winery and will comment, like, how do you get your wines to be so lush feeling in the mouth? And I think that's what we love to do, and that's what we're trying to do with our wine.
Is there a special trick to doing that? Or
I think it's just your intuitive response to the grapes that are in front of you. I mean, many of us have worked with the same vineyards and the same fruit from those vineyards, and our wines are all very, very different. And I maintain it's because all of us intuitively respond or react to what we're seeing, what we're tasting when we're crafting those wines. And that's the stamp of the winemaker.
Now, you have, in a very real sense, your own experience, because I think I'm correct in reading that did you build a new winery, or is the part of your website that talks about that the winery that was there when you started?
Oh, no. We built the winery from the ground up. So
okay.
We spent 3 years working at the Carlton Winemaker Studio, where we were in a co-op situation as we designed and built our current facility. So this winery that we're currently located in was finished in 2005, and we built and designed the winery.
Now when I tasted what you wanted, Pete, I said to Peter, I can't believe that the winery is so young.
Yeah, I was actually going to say something to you, sweetheart, because this is a name that won't be familiar to you, I don't think. But we met a wonderful winemaker from the Abruzzo region of Italy named Stefania Pepe.
Oh, uh-huh. Stefania.
And her father was a very traditional Abruzzese winemaker, making very fine wines. But she wanted to start off on her own, so she finally persuaded a bank to lend her enough money to go do that. And then she built a winery, which is a total gravity feed. So it's on three levels. The grapes go in at the top, and the wine, if you like, comes out at the bottom. And I'm sensing that your establishment must be a lot like that.
Exactly. Fruit starts at the top, and bottled wine comes out the bottom. We're also three levels of gravity flow. It's a beautiful building. And the other thing that's interesting about our building is it was designed with the idea that you should not physically have to hurt yourself to make wine in that facility. So we put an eye towards, one, I'm a woman and not as, say, strong as I'd like to be. So everything here can be moved or manipulated with a pallet jack or a forklift. And so there's a lot of space to move around and mechanically move your tank around so that there's nobody hurting themselves as they're trying to push or force something.
Now, talk to us about the range of wines you have. It's mostly Pinot Noir, but let's not forget there are other grapes that you're playing with as well. But you have several expressions of Pinot Noir.
That's correct. We have the current vintage, we have around 8 different bottlings of Pinot Noir. And so what we do, we source vineyard sites based on what we think they bring to our primary blend, which is the Willamette Valley. It is the largest production blend that we make. Keeping in mind that's very small when you compare us to, say, other wine regions. When we talk about Oregon, a lot of the Oregon wineries are very, very small. But the Willamette Valley is sourced fruit to craft and create a most consistent blend year in and year out. We also do very, very small bottlings that speak of the vineyards from which those grapes were harvested. So, for instance, we have our own estate, small bottling. We do a bottling from Shea, and there's 5 or 6 others that we do also. But we can't forget that we also make a lovely Viognier, where we source fruit from southern Oregon.
Okay, so you're not actually growing those grapes yourself?
No, we purchase those grapes.
It's really funny, because when the Campbells at Elk Cove were making Viognier about 8 or 10 years ago, I think we drank a significant percentage of how much they made.
Yeah.
Because they only made like 10 cases and we drank more than one.
Yeah, well, we started off that way with 15 cases of Viognier and I sold it out within a week. And so we're thinking, well, maybe people do like this grape. So we ended up actually increasing our production and we're currently up to producing about 1,000 cases of Viognier.
Oh, wow. But that's all fruit that you buy from somebody else.
Yes, all from southern Oregon. We don't grow it up here. I know there are some very small sites that are growing some Viognier up here, but our style is more of a richer, more honeyed fruit style than what we can get up here in the North Willamette Valley, where it's a little bit cooler.
Okay, so it's an issue if you don't get quite the ripeness.
Correct. You don't get quite the fruit development that I'm looking for. I mean, I believe that people who are making their Viogniers up here feel that they're getting the ripeness, but for me, it's a fruit characteristic that I'm sourcing, and I feel it needs a warmer climate.
Now,
Since you have such small production, who actually gets your wine?
who actually gets our wine. I would say the largest percentage of people who purchase our wines are either from our mailing list or who walk into our tasting room and enjoy a taste of our wines here at the winery in Newburgh. But we do have distribution outside of the state of Oregon. We're in 48 states and in Korea and Japan.
And you have a wine club as well.
We do, yes.
Now, Korea is a big market. Everybody keeps talking about selling wine to Korea. I just thought they didn't have enough money for food.
No, that's North Korea. That's a different Korea.
You mean South Korea, they have money for wine.
Oh, South Korea, they make cars better than America does.
Oh, okay.
they make TVs and cell phones better than we do. They're doing okay, thank you very much. Well, LG is a big brand there, too.
Well, we actually have a young man here who went to Lewis and Clark College, which is a college right close to the wine country here. He was so fascinated with it that he convinced his father to let him build a vineyard out here in Oregon, and so we are actually responsible for farming, managing, and making the wines, and then he's buying some of that wine and shipping it back to Korea.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? Now, you also make a Riesling, which is pretty lean.
Yes, yeah. I'm a fan of dry Riesling,
okay.
And I think that stylistically, Riesling is such a beautiful partner with food, and I really, really appreciate a very dry, austere Riesling. So we do craft our Riesling from very high-altitude sites, and we don't believe in a lot of sugar in it.
I noticed.
Peter, you liked it a lot.
I enjoyed it. I like a little more residual sugar in my Riesling, but I appreciated what Lynn was doing.
And you should have let me taste
it. I figured
that.
It out. The conversation we had about terroir when we were at Yolumba in South Australia, the lady who welcomed us there, who took care of us on one day when we visited the winery, she said, okay, now it's time to leave. This is about 5 o'clock. So we all jumped into her pickup truck and drove up to the hillside, up to this obvious area surrounded by vines, and then she stopped. We all got out of the car. She put down the tailgate, put two bottles of Riesling, six glasses on the tailgate, and said, we're going to taste some wine. And then she said, okay, now this one's from over there, and then this one's from over there, entirely different sides. I said, but Jane, I said, I already believed in terroir. You didn't have to drive me all the way up here.
But what a great, great opportunity.
It was a lot of fun. You also make Syrah.
We do. Yes.
And that's fairly unusual in Oregon, I think.
Well, I think it's unusual that you see someone in the north Willamette Valley making Syrah. Again, that comes from southern Oregon, and we do purchase the fruit. And for me, it was just a matter of having some fun, something to play around with that's different than Pinot Noir. I did grow up in Cabernet country, and so looking at what could I do up here in Oregon, I did make some Cabernet in the earlier years, but 1 out of 10 years it ripened, and so that was not really a fiscally sound proposal.
Yeah.
So we went south and looked at the Syrahs down there and just thought it would be really nice to have a different style of red wine to offer people.
I've been tweeting to Randall Graham, who's just producing a sparkling Syrah.
Oh, yes.
They are startling to see.
I thought you said he was doing a sparkling Albarino.
Well, he has three different ones. The one he's working on now is the Syrah.
Well, that's been a staple in Australia for
it's amazing
for
to
centuries.
See it. I mean, you realize what it looks like. I'm sure you do. That
looks like cherries soda.
Yeah.
I find it a little odd because I am a lover of champagne, and so when I see something sparkling, I have to readjust my thinking. And yes, we've had some sparkling Shiraz before.
But it is good stuff.
Yeah, it's a little heavier than I appreciate. I think I'm more into the nuanced styles of a good champagne.
Yeah, it's wedding wine in Australia.
Yeah.
Very, very, very much wedding wine. And you're making a wine. Now, Rubio is a name that sticks in my head.
Yes.
As if I've heard of somebody else making a wine called that.
Well, you know what? There may be in that instance. This was a nickname that I had when I was in the Napa Valley as a young woman. And so when it came time to craft a red table wine, we just wanted to put a fanciful name on it. And so we thought, oh, the nickname is perfect. We'll just put it on there.
And why were you called Rubio?
Well, I was actually called Rubia, which is the Spanish term for blondie. And we figured you couldn't put blondie on the bottle of a red wine.
No.
So we just kind of changed the name slightly and called it Rubio.
I don't know. You could. I mean, somebody's still making Marilyn Merlot.
Yeah. Yes, that's true.
she was fairly blonde on the bottle last time I remember.
Yes, I just remember Rolando and Ricardo very fondly because they were the two young men that used to call me that, and they would yell it across the cellar at Stag's Leap, and it was always a fond memory.
Oh, so you were at Stag's Leap, too?
I was.
Well, you checked out a few places to make sure you picked as many people's brains as possible, huh?
Exactly. I've got a sparkling background. I've got a still white wine background from Chateau St. Jean, and then I have my red wine background from Stag's Leap Wine Cellar.
And now you're making a name for yourself in Pinot Noir.
In Pinot Noir. Who would have known?
I'm guessing that probably you got a following pretty quickly, because you were already known as the winemaker at Rex Hill anyway, right?
That's correct, yes.
So what did they do after you left, for heaven's sake?
They had to find a new winemaker.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, that was a challenge.
One thing you said you were going to talk about you haven't yet is about how well it keeps.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, that's a good, I was going to ask Lynn what next, but let's go backwards and say, well, you have wines going back almost to the beginning?
We have wines going back to our very first vintage as Panarash Wine Cellars, and that would be 1998. And we just recently did a 10-year retrospective of those wines, and we were blown away by how wonderfully well some of the wines were aging. Interesting thing to note is some of those wines were wines we would not have guessed would have aged as well as they did. Vintages like 2001, 2007, both were vintages that were considered to be cool and wet in press kind of reaction to our weather patterns that took place. And yet, they're beautiful. There's a focus to those wines, and there's an elegance to those wines, which I would not have anticipated. So I think that it's pretty exciting in Oregon. We're building wines that do age, and we're starting to get some history, enough timeline under our belt to say, yes, our wines do age. Earlier in the early years when I first got here, it was kind of hard to say how long do Oregon Pinots age, because many of us had only been crafting wines for 5 years. We've now been crafting wines for well over 40 years, and there is some beautiful, beautiful wine in the bottle from years past.
Now, I remember when we were talking to Adam Campbell at Elk Cove, we asked him to go back to the beginning, and why did his father, who was a doctor, decide that he wanted to make wine? And I think, I don't know whether it was Adam or whether it was Mrs. Campbell who said, now, exactly how many Oregon Pinot Noirs have you sampled? And he couldn't remember whether he'd ever drunk any at all.
Yeah.
So at least you had a running start. You had a 15-year running start. Now,
right.
What's next? What hill do you yet have to climb?
What hill? Well, you know, that's interesting that you asked me that. I've climbed Everest and I've killed... Oh, you don't mean that.
Well, if you've climbed Everest, that certainly gives us a pretty good idea that you're kind of a determined young lady.
Yeah. There's so much going on in Oregon, and we're still a relatively young vineyard area, and I think it's been really, really fun to be on the ground floor of all that and see how it's changed and evolved. And it's really important to me as we explore these different areas that we continue to honor the landscape around us, that we're not building just vineyards everywhere, that we have to really respect the land use laws and keeping Oregon as beautiful as it currently is. For me, I think the next big challenge is just kind of finding that next vineyard site that's going to become part of our small vineyard designate series. We usually work with a vineyard for 3 to 5 years before we'll actually qualify it as a vineyard designate in our portfolio. So it means we go out and we look at vineyard sites. We start growers with their plantings and help them from the ground up in the hopes that one vineyard site might be the one.
Okay, so not all these wines are estate wines.
No. We actually purchase almost 80% of our fruit. Our own estate is about 20% of our production.
But you're watching the growing process very carefully, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. We actually have some lease arrangements where, though we don't own the property, we're leasing the vineyard on that land. So we have about, I'd say, another 50-plus acres that we have a lease arrangement on. And then the other acreage we actually purchase from the growers on an acreage contract.
Well, let's hope that Oregon doesn't become Route 29 in California.
No.
We can remember.
How many years ago was it I said, this is a place where we should come and set up, like, it's sort of like Napa was before Napa got to be horrible Napa.
Yeah. Well,
that was years ago.
Fortunately, you can still escape. You can still escape from Route 29 and drive the Silverado Trail, and most people don't know that.
Exactly.
But if I were to say to our listening audience, imagine that you've been in California and you've driven the Silverado Trail, Oregon's going to remind you of that an awful lot.
It's true. I mean, you drive that back North Valley Road out to wine country here, and you see these beautiful trees, vineyards, and hillsides of peach trees and some filberts. It's a gorgeous drive-in every morning.
Well, you've done marvels. Your wine is marvelous as well. And you sounded like so much fun. I thought, boy, this is somebody I'd like to hang with until you started talking about mountain climbing. Pass on this hanging with you.
We love a good adventure out here. My husband and I do certainly love to go and try something new every couple of years. So.
Well, please give your husband our very best regards. We wish you continued success, which we feel is assured.
Thank you,
listeners, this is a wine worth digging around for. Trust us, as of course you do. Penner-Ash should be on the list of wines you're putting in your cellar. Lynn, thank you so much for joining us today, and we're looking forward to the pleasure of drinking more of the beautiful wine that you sent us.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here today.
And they really are delicious wines. Do yourself a favor. And in the meantime, we'll be back right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Here we are again with some more notes on fabulous wines.
Moving right along.
Who's up?
Allison Sokolblosser. do that 10 times in a hurry.
Right.
With a glass of wine in your hand.
Yeah.
Anyway, here's an equally fascinating story.
Listeners, I have to tell you that Peter's really jealous this morning. And Anne's really jealous too, I guess. But certainly I am jealous because I'm talking to someone who has the good fortune to be a winemaker in Oregon. One of the world's wonderful places for making a wine that seduces everyone who drinks it, called Pinot Noir. And Allison Sokolblosser, how did you get to be so lucky?
I grew up in a family that had the crazy idea of planting Pinot Noir grapes in Oregon, and now, 40 years later, I'm running the business with my brother. So I just guess I was born this way.
And it feels good almost every morning?
Yes, it's a great feeling.
Have your father and mother ever shared with you what caused them to embark on this rather crazy direction in their lives?
I think crazy is the right word, because they absolutely had a pretty big dose of craziness to do what they did, and I'm very grateful that they did. They were young, they were history majors, they met in college, and they were told, you can do anything with a liberal arts degree. And they were coming to Oregon in their Volkswagen camper bus in the late 60s, early 70s, and they decided, you know what, it'd be really fun to plant a vineyard. Why not? People have been making wine forever. It can't be that hard. And so they had day jobs as teachers, and they started driving around the countryside looking for a piece of property. And they settled on 5 acres in the Dundee Hills, and it was an old prune orchard. They, nights and weekends and so forth, they cleared the property and planted vines, and slowly but surely acquired more land and planted more grapes. And then, so the first vines were planted in 71, and they made their first vintage of a Pinot in 77.
It's absolutely amazing that this can happen in a lifetime.
Seems
like it ought to take at least several lifetimes to get that far along, don't you think?
It is amazing that from when they started in 1971 to today, there's over 500 wineries in Oregon, and you can find Oregon wines all over the world. It's really amazing how far we've come in a generation.
Was it just a lucky strike, do you think? Why they chose Pinot Noir and why it flourished?
Well, I think it's a combination of luck and hard work. They worked so incredibly hard. They did do a lot of research, and their theory was that the spot that they chose, if it had been successful as orchards, it could be a good place to grow grapes. It's very risky, though, because they chose a grape, Pinot Noir, that had never done well in the United States. They chose Oregon, which was a completely unproven place to grow wine grapes. And then they themselves had no viticulture or enology or business or any farming background. So all the odds were against them. And so that's where the combination of luck and just sheer determination and hard work came in. And the other thing that can't be overlooked is the collaboration. There were a handful of folks who had that same idea and were also trying to grow Pinot Noir here in Oregon. And everyone worked together. Everyone shared things that worked well, things that didn't work so well, and collaborated to help create the industry that we have today.
Right, so they were friends and collaborators rather than competitors. And I think we've been to the Oregon wine country several times. We really love it. And one of the things we love about it is that the people are so friendly, and you all seem to get along so well.
We do. You know, when you're driving down the highway and you're trying to, and somebody comes in and is trying to merge, the person on the highway will actually slow down and let you get on the highway. That's Oregon. That kind of thing doesn't happen in a lot of other states.
No, I remember talking to, can't remember her first name, the lady who runs Willis. Mackenzie?
And she, Ronnie.
And Ronnie. And she and her husband are divorced, but they still both live on the property.
Exactly. And my parents actually got divorced in 99 and yet are still great friends and business partners. We're still family running the business together, and yet they're both remarried.
Now, was there a particular, just to get a little bit technical, was there a particular clone or series of clones of Pinot Noir that were selected for Oregon?
So the original clones that we worked with were Pommard and Badensville, and then we also tried some Pinot Droit. Now with, and then we also planted some Chardonnay, and we used Winty clones from California, which came to find out did not work that well in Oregon. And so now a lot of the newer plantings, we're still using some of the Pommard and Badensville, but we've incorporated a lot of some of the Dijon clones, more the designer clones. And the newer Chardonnay plantings in Oregon are also those Dijon clones, which are a lot more successful up here in Oregon.
So it's very much the Northern Rhone home clones. Going back to, going back only as far as the end of the phylloxera epidemic, but still the home of the grapes that are associated with the Northern Rhone.
Well, and the interesting thing about phylloxera is that when my parents started, they knew phylloxera existed, but there was no research to tell them what kind of rootstock to use here in Oregon. And so some researchers even said, oh, it's too cold in Oregon for phylloxera to exist. So all of our original vines were self-rooted. And we were, I think, maybe the second vineyard in Oregon to get phylloxera. And so we've had to go through and completely replant our entire vineyard. Everything planted since late 80s, early 90s in Oregon is on phylloxera-resistant American rootstock.
No, I was thinking back to the clones that you chose, which were ones from the famous Northern Rhone region of France, where Chardonnay and Pinot Noir are the predominant grapes. But I guess they were killed off by the phylloxera epidemic back in the 1870s, mm-hmm. Right? So they must have planted something new after that in order to be successful in dealing with this problem in the, And you've gone through the same experience, I guess.
We have gone through the same experience. It was interesting. And planting the vineyard also allowed us to add some of the newer clones and to change the spacing in our vineyard as well. So, and we even changed some of the varietals.
Okay, so you essentially got to implement new ideas that had come along, which you might not otherwise have done if you hadn't been unplanting anyway. If you hadn't
exactly.
been replanting anyway.
Expensive way to do it, but the end result was very positive and good for us.
Talk to us a little bit about the range of wines that you make, starting off perhaps with the one with something that you, I don't suppose you would call it exactly a flagship, but it was certainly the sample that you chose to send us, which is Dundee Hills 2010 Pinot Noir, and then go on from there to talk about the whole family.
I love that. Absolutely love
it. Oh, thank you. Yes, that is our flagship. That's our classic Pinot Noir. It's where everything begins for us. Our estate vineyard, we've got about 120 acres, 85 are planted. We're fully planted out. We're certified organic in our vineyards, and everything starts in the vineyard, trying to get this quality fruit, farming for low yields and really making sure that we're getting ripe and intense flavors that reflect the soil where that fruit is grown. All of our Pinot spends 16 months in French oak barrels, and then it has at least 6 months of bottle age before we release it. And that 2010 Dundee Hills Pinot is just tasting beautifully. It was a really well-balanced, classic Oregon vintage, and it's something that you can enjoy now and then also drink for a long time to come. In addition to the Dundee Hills, which is basically a blend of everything off of our estate vineyard, we also make little single block bottlings from different distinct parts within our vineyard. And those are very limited in production and are meant to really reflect that specific spot where those grapes were grown. One of the really fun things to do is when folks come out here to Oregon, we offer different tours either by foot or by RTV where you can actually walk through the vineyard, hike through the vineyard or ride through the vineyard and taste those wines right in the specific spot where the grapes were grown.
That's great. That's a wonderful
so,
thing.
Yeah, it's a fun way to experience it and really connect that wine is an agricultural product and it's from the land. And you really get that sense when you're doing that. We make it's the different single blocks. They all have sentimental value for me. So sometimes it's hard for me to discern between the taste and my memories of growing up in those particular blocks. So the Goosepin block is always a favorite because that was right next to the house growing up, and it was named for an experiment that my parents did trying to put geese in the vineyard to weed.
Oh, did that
which
work?
Was pretty humorous. That did not work.
That
didn't work.
I guess the geese liked it, but the vines didn't.
Exactly. Well, the geese weren't too effective. They were more interested in being near us rather than weeding a 2-acre vineyard.
Now you've gone beyond Pinot Noir, I guess. So you make a rosé of Pinot Noir, which is an interesting
idea.
We do.
So rosé of Pinot Noir. We have a Pinot Gris, which is our dry white. And France originally planted some Chardonnay, but that did not grow quite as well in our spot. And so when we replanted, we put in some Pinot Gris, which has been doing very well. And Pinot Gris is very dry, mineral, steely. It's got nice fresh fruit. And it's quite crisp and refreshing. And then we also have a white Riesling dessert wine that we do just in very small quantities. And then we have two different blends that are more, you know, where we're purchasing most of the fruit that goes into it. And we have a white and a red.
These are the ones called Evolution?
Yes, those are the ones called Evolution.
Now, I'm looking at an extract from your website at this moment, and I see also Miller Thurgau and Muscat.
Yes, so we originally started, it was Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris, or sorry, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, and then my parents even did a little bit of Cabernet, they tried Miller Thurgau, they tried Riesling, they tried some Gewürztraminer, so they were hoping it was going to be Pinot Noir, but just to hedge their bets, they tried a little bit of everything. And then when we replanted, it became just Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris, with a tiny bit of Riesling and Miller Thurgau. So every once in a while, we do make a Miller Thurgau bottling, which is just really fun. It's only a couple hundred cases. We sell it here in the tasting room. And then the Muscat is one of the main components that goes into the Evolution white blend. And every once in a while, you're tasting through it, and it's like, wow, this is so good. Why don't we just bottle some a little bit on its own? So we do make a couple of those esoteric whites. Occasionally, we'll do a Pinot Blanc as well. That's a couple hundred cases, sort of fun things to put in our tasting room for folks who make the trip all the way out here to try.
Right. I think we've drunk the Evolution before. It reminds me, and this is not to suggest that two wines I'm going to mention are better or worse, but there's a California wine called Alluvium and another one called Conundrum. Yeah, I think Evolution's a bit like that.
It is, and when we came out with Evolution, the only other white blend was Conundrum, and we sort of thought of Evolution as Conundrum without the oak, and that's a little bit more accessible of a price point, and it's still stayed true to that, and now there's a gazillion more white blends out there as well.
Now, that really good news for people across most of the country. In our home state of Pennsylvania, sadly, that's not completely true, but these wines are in pretty wide distribution, and you have a nationwide and international sales organization that brings your wines to market, right?
We do. We are in all 50 states and quite a few countries as well.
And you encourage people to come and visit?
We love visitors. Oregon is a great destination for folks who love food and the outdoors and experiencing nature, and there's not only good wine, but there's also great breweries and great tea shops, and we have a pretty good life out here. And for those coming, especially from the southern part of the U.S., come in more time. July, August, September are stunningly beautiful. There's no humidity here normally. It may be one or two days we'll get a little bit of humidity, but pretty much no humidity. And the weather's gorgeous, and the scenery's beautiful. So it's a fun place to come visit.
And you can roll down the road from Portland in about 45 minutes?
We are. We're about 45 minutes to an hour from Portland, and there's, you know, at least 150 wineries within probably an hour and a half of Portland. So, you know, there's a lot to see, a lot to do. There's some beautiful places to stay and delicious restaurants to dine at. So there's a lot to do. So you can check out the Sokol Blosser website, which is S-O-K-O-L-B-L-O-S-S-E-R, sokolblosser.com. Some other great resources would be the Willamette Valley Wineries Association website, which is willamettewines.com. And Willamette rhymes with damn it. That's how you can remember that one. It's Willamette, wines.com. And then the last one would be the Oregon Wine Board website, which I believe is oregonwine.org.
Yeah, we've had some dealings with them in the past. We love coming to Oregon, so won't take much for us to find an excuse to come by and taste some wines with you in person. What a pleasure that would be. And
You really know your stuff, Allison, I have to tell you.
Thank you. Well, I'd love to have you guys come out. We're actually building a brand new tasting room that's going to open in July. Our original tasting room was built in 78, and we've just sort of outgrown it over the years. And so we're very excited about the new space that's opening July 1st. So come visit me after that.
Great.
Fine. And there's another generation growing up around wines like you and your brothers did. So
absolutely.
So you're sure the family name is sure to continue?
That's the goal. Alex and I, running the business together, we really view us more as stewards rather than owners, and so our goal is to hand the business off to the third generation in even better shape than we received it from our parents, which was great and very generous. So, yep, we've got, what is it, 6 members so far in the third generation, ranging from age 4 to 12. And Alex and I are looking forward to paying it forward, putting the work as soon as they are able.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a lovely story. It's almost more of a French or a German story or an Italian story than it is an American story. since family business is not a big in the United States in the wine industry, except perhaps in your beautiful part of the world. So once again, Alison, thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll look forward to continuing to raise a glass of Sokol Blosser every once in a while.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be with you today.
Just in case you didn't get the message, these are truly delicious wines, and these are two pretty adventurous ladies, right? Talk about being willing to take a chance, being willing to put your money where your mouth is. All of that kind of stuff applies. And these are people whose wines you will enjoy if you can buy them, and people you'd enjoy visiting with if you have a chance. It's one of the most beautiful parts of these United States. Don't you agree, sweetheart?
Yes, I do.
Okay, great. And we'll be back after the break with more about wine.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I've always been totally entranced with people who are really, really expert at handling language. And Jay McInerney, our next guest, not only does he know about wine and writes beautifully about it, but you can drink in his words. They're so good.
There you go.
So, I just think he's marvelous.
Yeah. So when we heard that he was the best writer about wine that had ever been, of course we had to get him on the program and bring him to you. They write that Jay McInerney, did I get that anywhere close pronunciation-wise?
That's good.
Which I'm guessing is Irish, not Scottish.
Yes, it's Irish.
It's one of those names that confuses everybody. You've written several books about wine.
This is my The Juice is my third collection of essays about wine, yes.
Well, first of all, we said book.
The first one was called Bacchus and Me, and the second one was called A Hedonist in the Cellar.
But these are
I read that one.
But these are unusual books because they're not books that have new writing in them. They're books which are collections of work you've already published.
Most of them, yes. Most of them in this case are essays I first wrote for the Wall Street Journal in my capacity as wine columnist there. I try to write them without an expiration date, basically, and I like to think some of them might have been improved with age.
That's why everybody thinks you're such a fine writer, is because you write about issues that age on them. They have age on them already, and they continue to have age on them going to the future.
Has anybody mentioned
the title of the book?
It's called The Juice.
Venus Veritas.
Which is kind of sommelier slang for wine, really. The sort of highest praise that a sort of wine geek or a sommelier can bestow is to say that something is sick juice. That means it's good.
I see. Okay,
sick
thick juice, right?
I thought he said sick.
Sick.
Oh, wow, okay.
Sick, that's the whole... Oh, yeah,
that's
you
the whole
didn't
concept,
know about that. Sick, yes. Could I say books are so literary? You're actually an accomplished, experienced novelist. So you write beautifully anyway, and this just happens to be about wine.
Yes, well, it was something that I am passionate about.
Right, but
how did you get to be that way to begin with?
Well, it was a gradual process, but when I was writing my first novel, Bright Lights, Big City, I was actually working as a clerk in a wine store in Syracuse, New York, and that was, I suppose, in some ways the beginning. I used to read the wine books that the owner had on a shelf in the store, and I used to take home a bottle every night and try the, you know, sort of Yugoslavian Cabernet. There was actually still a Yugoslavia when I started, in graduate school. And I just kind of gradually developed a palate from the bottom up. And the more I became intrigued. And when my first novel was published, I was finally able to afford some of the better stuff. And that just happened to coincide. That was in 1985, which just happened to coincide with the release of the 1982, the famous 1982 Bordeaux vintage in this country. And I bought a lot of that, and I just kept going. It was a hobby that got a little bit out of control.
Well, I want to pick on just a few of the stories, just so that our listeners can understand what they're going to get under the cover when they read all the other ones. Now, let's start up with a wine that has way too much fame. It's probably the most famous lousy wine that anybody made, and the story of how it came to conquer the United States market. We're talking about Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio. Tell us a little bit of the story.
Well, this is a relatively recent phenomenon. I guess it really, Santa Margherita sort of started to take the American market by storm. And I first remember appearing in the late 80s at Elaine's, where we all hung out. But the story is, apparently, that an American wine importer named Tony Terlato was scouring Italy for new wines. And he tasted a wine in Alto Adige that he rather liked. It was a Pinot Grigio. He then sort of sponsored a tasting of as many of these. Pinot Grigio is the name of the grape. It means gray Pinot. It's called Pinot Gris in France. And he particularly liked wine made by a domain called Santa Margherita, which I'm sure was very, very much smaller at the time. And he started importing it to the States. And I don't know, I think they import like 500,000 cases or something by this time. I think its popularity has to do with the fact that it's relatively inoffensive.
It's wine for people who don't like wine.
Yeah. It's not terribly full of character. It's not brimming with character, let's put it this way. But neither is it offensive. And somehow it's just because I think it's the best-selling white wine in America. I'm not sure. It's certainly the best-selling imported wine, unless Yellowtail has overtaken it recently.
Yellowtail is on its tail, that's for sure.
There are some serious Pinot Grigios out there that are made with low yields and sort of painstaking winemaking, but the majority of them are just sort of easy to drink and hard to remember.
Well, you, in piece on that subject, you mention a winery name that we'd recognize, one we've actually been to, called V de Romans.
Yes.
Which, as I said before we came on the air, is notorious in our minds for the fact that the winemaker and owner's name is, his name is Gallo.
Yes. He's unable to use his own name because of the very litigious American Gallo family.
Yeah, I think they threatened.
Yeah, I'm sure they
I'm not sure they actually sued, but they certainly threatened. But it's a delightful vineyard, and whenever we see one of their white or red wines on a wine list, we know it's great, and we grab it right away.
And they make a blend, a very good blend, which includes Pinot Grigio, and it is indeed a great winery. This is in Friuli, which makes, to my mind, the best Italian white wines.
Right.
Italy is not famous for its whites, and that is to say, they tend to be less complex and less interesting than white Burgundies from France or Alsatian Rieslings, for instance. But the best ones, unquestionably, I think, come from Friuli.
Yeah, we toured a lot of them there. Yeah. Peter would remember the names of them. But
Lydia
Bastianich and Joe Bastianich has a vineyard there.
Yes, yeah, it's really Joe's project.
Joe's.
He makes very, very good white wines. The one that I like the best is called Vespa.
That's the one I was just going to mention that.
It's a Chardonnay-based wine. Really, really quite lovely.
It means wasp in Italian. Vespa. It does. Don't you? The Vespas, the motor bikes.
Yeah.
To finish out the Pinot Grigio story, the Pinot Gris story, if you come to the United States and Oregon, then you'll find some very, very, very acceptable white wines.
It's a grape that's caught on in Oregon for a variety of reasons, and they make some very good examples of it. I mean, if you can find an Oregon Pinot Gris in the sort of $18, $20 range, chances are you'll be getting a pretty good wine. They tend to cost less than Oregon Chardonnays, partly because Chardonnay is a more famous grape.
Yeah, exactly. Now let's change countries and let's change styles of wine and talk a little bit about Rioja. And you start out your story about old Rioja by saying some uncomplimentary things about over-extracted wines and so on and so forth. So go over that little bit of it for us.
Well, unfortunately, even as winemaking quality has improved around the world, there's also been a tendency toward a kind of international style, which some of us find a little boring. And partly because of the tastes of some of the most influential critics, and people often point to Robert Parker. Many, many, certainly The Wine Spectator also falls in this category. Many people try to make big, super ripe, some of us would say even overripe, wines with lots of oak influence from new oak barrels that tend to draw high scores from these sources, or at least that's the perception. And the problem with these wines is that they could be from anywhere. I mean, the riper a wine is, the harder it is to distinguish more subtle characteristics besides sugar and alcohol. And one of the reasons that I love Old Rioja is because it's a wine that has some secondary characteristics. Wonderful earthy, smoky, mushroomy quality that you just don't find in these big, overripe, internationally styled wines.
Now, we visited the Rhoda project.
Yeah.
When it was just a project, when they were selling their grapes because they couldn't use them to make a decent Rioja, they thought. And now they've come much further along, making really fine wines.
That's a real state-of-the-art winery. That's probably the most meticulously run and technologically advanced winery that I've seen in Spain. They also make an extraordinarily good olive oil. I don't know if you got that while you were there.
I think we took some away with us, along with some Rhoda, too. Now, another property very close by, I think the town is Aro, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, H-A-R-O.
Was a winery called Valanciso, or Valanciso, which was owned by a man called Valentine and a woman called Cisco. And I don't know if you know them or not.
I know of them, but I haven't visited. But Aro is the sort of the center of the Rioja wine trade, and one of my favorites is right there next to the train station, which is Lopez de Hereda. I don't know if you had a chance to visit them. Extraordinary wines.
We know the name.
They have the oldest looking cellars I've ever seen. It's sort of like a Bela Lugosi movie. When you go down there, there's cobwebs and mold. In fact, they don't tend to release their wines until they're at least 10 or 15 years old, which is quite extraordinary.
The Valanciso guys, I remember, they said, "We only make one wine. We always wanted to make wine." And they'd been making it in other people's vineyards. I mean, in other people's cellars for quite a long time before they built their own. But they said, "We only want to make one, and it's a Reserva. That's all we want to make."
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really rather...
Yes.
Now, I want to move to a different country again, to come back to these good old United States and remind you of the story that you wrote about Montebello.
Ah, yes. Ridge.
You eventually said Ridge at Last or something like that is the name of your piece.
Well, it's funny because when I started writing about wine, I visited Napa on a number of occasions. And in the mid-90s, there were a lot of these so-called cult Cabernets that were just going into production. These very small production, very modern-styled, highly extracted, super ripe wines that are easy to love. And they're also easy to get tired of, I think. And my palate kind of shifted away from that style of wine. Ridge has been around since 1968. And they have stuck to a style of wine which I think is more enduring and is really what I think Bordeaux probably used to taste like long, long, long ago. Their wines are slow to come around. They age forever. The Ridge Montebello, recently they restaged the
famous Judgment of Paris tasting.
Yeah. Well, actually 2006 they restaged it. The original one was in 1976. And the Ridge Montebello 1973 came in first out of all the French wines and all the American ones. In 1976, it placed fifth, partly, I think, because it takes the wines a long time to really show their stuff. But they have been making wine the same way for many, many years. It's just a classic wine, the Ridge Montebello, and they also did a great deal to popularize Zinfandel in this country. Well, Cabernet production is very small, and they needed some cash flow, and they started making Zinfandel from vineyards near a winery, and their Zinfandels are quite extraordinary, and so also quite long-lived, although unlike the Cabernet, you can drink them on release.
It's really funny because Paul Draper, who's the owner and winemaker at Ridge, has been nominated as the Wine and Spirits Professional by the James Beard Organization probably at least 15 or 20 times. I think he finally won either last year or the year before.
Yes,
he wasn't long overdue.
He's one of the most interesting characters in wine. He actually was a philosophy major at Stanford. And
there are lots of wine guys, by the way, who are philosophy graduates.
Well, that got a degree in philosophy at Williams many years ago. And so I am naturally drawn to Draper partly for that reason. He's quite a character, and he toured Europe for quite a long time. And then he went to Chile when Allende was president and got involved with some agricultural programs there. Eventually sort of went sideways into winemaking and ended up back near Sanford where he had gone to college. It's funny because the Ridge Vineyard is one of the most remote locations, or it seems to be one of the most remote and pristine pieces of the California landscape you can imagine. But if you look over the other side, there's Silicon Valley just a few miles away.
Oh, is that so? It's not close to Napa at all.
No, it's completely removed. Well, 2.5 hours away, probably. It's about an hour south of San Francisco.
It's really remarkable. Now you did a story on Aussie fruit bombs too.
On Aussie fruit bombs?
Yes, I think so.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, Australia really kind of made a name for itself with these incredibly rich, powerful, ripe Syrahs, mostly, which they call Shiraz.
Right.
And for a while, they did extremely well with this style. And then, honestly, two things happened. Well, number one was that the Australian dollar appreciated ridiculously. And secondly, wine fashion kind of moved away from them. People began to look for a little more restraint and a little less sort of blueberry jam in their glass of wine. And at the same time that Robert Parker stopped personally reviewing Australian wines, and a couple of the importers went bankrupt. And anyway, long story short, the Australian wine market kind of, in this country, kind of collapsed. And they're now best known for their cheap wine, like Yellowtail. In fact, there's a very big range of very interesting wines being made in Australia, and I think they will gradually be rediscovered in this country.
Have you gotten into Tasmanian wines?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Tasmania seems to be a very good place to grow Pinot Noir. And
yeah, have you met Andrew Peary?
No, I have not.
Oh, he's wonderful.
Well, we'll tell you a story, and maybe you'll even write this story. It's really fascinating. This man's name is Dr. Andrew Peary, and we assumed he was a medical doctor.
Right.
And he founded a winery in Tasmania called Piper's Brook, named in the Tamar Estuary area on the north coast of Tasmania. What we discovered when we met him, we had been to his winery before, a number of years before. We met him in 2008, the last time we were in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time he was out of Piper's Brook. But we found out that his doctorate was in enology. He had the very first doctorate in enology that was ever awarded by the wine school in South Australia. It's called Rosemont or Roseworthy or Rosemount or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But his thesis was that you could grow wine grapes in Tasmania. Now, always before, enologists and other specialists and other agriculturalists had said the line where you can grow grapes ends at the coast of Victoria and South
right.
Australia, and nowhere south of this will you be able to grow grapes. So he said, he put his money where his mouth is, I said, and said, I don't believe you. My belief is that we can grow Pinot Noir very nicely here. Thank you very much. And he founded an industry which has been enormously successful, and they're making great sparkling wines there too, made out of guess what?
Yes, probably Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir and Chardonnay.
Yeah.
He subsequently sold the vineyard, split with his wife, and she needed the money or something like that.
Well, I haven't actually had the wines, but I will.
Well, Piper's Brook is a different owner now. It's owned by a large either Belgian or Dutch beverage company. But I'm sure it's still a great vineyard. Peary Estates is worthwhile getting, and there's a wonderful sparkling wine called Jantz, which is in the same area too. And of course, if you really have fun, you can go to Yolumba and you can stay at Percy's. Percy's is the house that was built on the vineyard.
One of my favorite stories. Well, actually, the book concludes with one of my favorite stories, which is about my fellow editor at House and Garden. When I was very fortunate. My first wine column was for House and Garden magazine. The editor-in-chief was a friend of mine who knew about my passion for wine, named Dominique Browning, and she was the one who convinced me that I should write a wine column, which I was initially reluctant to do, but eventually I took to it. And Condé Nast was, let's say, just very generous in those days. I flew around the world with the food editor, Laura Zarub, who taught me a great deal about food and also about wine. But we sought out some of the great food and wine treasures of Europe and South America and California. Our partnership was sealed one day in a French police station where we were where we were locked up briefly after failing a breathalyzer test at a roadblock. We had driven 2 hours south of Strasbourg to visit an auctioneer that Laura was desperate to find. A man named Bernard Antony, who had been discovered by Alain Ducasse, and he must have given us 30 or 40 or 50 cheeses to sample, and almost as many wines. And when we finally left his place at about 11 at night, we were, I guess we were a little bit over the legal limit.
Just a little bit, huh?
The poor police, yes. The French police officers who arrested us were sort of horrified once they realized we were foreigners. But they sort of held us for 3 or 4 hours, and finally they just drove us near our car and said, just get out of here and don't come back. And that way but I had many, many wonderful adventures in my days with Laura. And today that I got a phone call in 2007 saying that House and Garden was no longer with us. They closed it rather abruptly. But it was a great adventure for me, and I thought that, you know, I thought that I would be finished with wine writing and just go back to my life as a novelist until 2010 when the Wall Street Journal came calling, and I'm happy to be back.
Well, we're delighted you're back. We're delighted that you produced this third anthology of your work, and I'm sure there are more in the future. And listeners, you should look out for them. And what day of the week is your column in the journal?
It's on Saturday.
Saturday, okay. So,
in fact, you will see, yes, this coming Saturday. Watch for my latest.
Thank you so much.
It's in the section called Off Duty.
Okay, and you didn't get a Pulitzer for Bright Lights, Big City.
And that's in a bookstore near you, anytime.
Jay McEnany, thank you so much.
Jay, what a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
All right, well,
thank
you so much. It was great to talk to you.
Thanks, Jay.
Okay, bye-bye.
So we sure hope you enjoyed today's adventures in hearing about and listening about and telling stories about wine, and that you'll join us again same time, same place next week for more exciting On the Menu about food, wine, travel across the world.
Bye-bye.